Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. Clearly, none of you are taking exams this week. It's also very brave of you to come during the middle of the day. My name is Ehtisham Ahmed. For me, this is my almost 30 years to the day when I actually started work at Stickard, full-time. I was at Stickard running the Development Economics Research Center in 1986. But then I went on to on leave of absence to the IMF, and the leave of absence became a stay of 25 years. But I'm back at LSE, and I've been at the Asia Center. Ruth has been very kind. And now, I think, as of this month, back in Stickard. So for me, it's sort of homecoming. I've been working on multi-level finance issues for quite a long time, and including at the IMF. And whilst I was at the IMF, I had the pleasure of meeting Professor Brosio. He's Professor Emeritus of Public Finance at the University of Turin. And we've had the pleasure of working together, started working together in China in 1984, Colombia, I think it was Mexico, Bolivia, Nigeria, Indonesia, and a few other countries in between. So we've had the pleasure of working together and also writing several books, some of which you may have come across, including most recently the Handbook of Multilevel Finance last year, which sort of brings together particularly political economy approaches to multilevel finance. Professor Brosio, until recently, was also president of the Italian Public Finance Society. We have a third co-author or co-editor. It's Professor Massimo Bordigno, who is the current president of the Italian Public Finance Society. And it happens that he's actually teaching in Milan today, so he couldn't make it. We originally thought of having a general presentation and one or two case studies, but we decided against that because the case studies are actually very interesting and there are problems in a lot of countries that we actually cover. But I thought we'd spend this afternoon drawing lessons for the individual countries, lessons for the European, shall we say, the European project. But I also hold the Pao Yukong Chair at the University of Zhejiang in China, which I think is probably the largest university in China, maybe the second largest. Looks the largest to me, it's huge. But since I work in China and also in South Asia, you know, the question you always get in China or in South Asia, or even I work a lot in Latin America, the question is, well, what's happening in Europe? And what is the relevance of the European experience for us? And that's a question that I'm going to keep at the back of my mind and will address as we go along. So we're talking about the multi-level issues. It's not the full crisis. It's how the multi-level issues, particularly the incentives and the structures in Europe, how did they contribute to the crisis? What were the effects and what are the solutions going forward? So the focus is on the multi-level issues. And this is also relevant because, you know, whether you're in China or you're in India or you're in Pakistan or you're in Mexico, you know, there's a presumption that decentralization, European style or US style, is good for you. Now, it may well be, and indeed we keep that as a maintained hypothesis, but the question is really, what are the lessons from Europe, and has decentralization worked or has it not? So let's start with, you know, the Eurozone as a laboratory. And to us, you know, this Eurozone is actually a very good laboratory of, you know, what happens in multilevel finance, particularly looking at the political economy of how governments interact. And the way governments interact in the for example, the United States, very different to the way governments interact in the European context. There are differences within European countries too, across European countries, within regions in Europe. So really what the study of Europe suggests and has suggested is that there are very substantial differences from the models which essentially derive from, you know, post-Second World War, writing by Musgrave and others, which are called the normative theories, very US-based normative theories of public finance, to really positive theories, which is really looking at how the political economy of public finance operates. So the contrast between Europe and the United States are actually quite interesting, both from the actual policy perspective and from the perspective of theory. So the question is, you know, to what extent did the fact that you have multi-levels of government in the European Union, how did that affect the crisis? And then what happened as a result of the shock? How did the impact on national public finances affect the finances of regions and local governments? And really what you see as a result of the shocks is that many of the fault lines in Europe began to be clearer. So there are fault lines, particularly regarding the generation of liabilities and responsibility for liabilities. And we'll talk a little bit about this because it's important. So essentially what you had as a result of the shock is gameplay between governments at the most junior level, say between municipalities and regions, between regions and national governments, and between national governments and Brussels, or the ECB, or Berlin. So in a sense, it's a gameplay which you see very clearly as a result of the crisis. That's something that really interests us. So we also look at the results of the adjustment process. You had a macro adjustment. This worked its way down to tightening of budgets, had implications for effective service delivery, has had implications for public sector employment, private sector employment, and sustainability of the employment position, leading to questions about political sustainability of the European compact. So the question of the political sustainability is really a big issue in countries like Portugal, like Spain, with elections coming up yet again, Greece. There are issues also, there are problems in Germany as well. So we'll come to, you know, the faults in each one of these cases and then look at how these lessons can provide suggestions for countries like China. So really, I always keep the European context as the relevant, you know, what people look at. So really you're looking also at centrifugal forces. If you're looking at Spain, you're looking at, of course, the Basque country, and then the asymmetric arrangements. Then you're looking at pressures from Catalonia. You're looking at pressures from other regions within Spain. You look at problems in Italy, the asymmetric arrangements. So really there are lessons for theory from the crisis. The lessons for policy within individual European countries and for the European compact. You're looking at issues about competition across jurisdictions, which is a theory called yardstick competition. Besley and Case, Pierre Salmon have written about these issues, and many of you probably know about it. The issue of subsidiarity, how does it work? Does it actually work? What does it mean? What level do you push things down to? And can you make it work? The issue of fiscal rules. Do local governments behave themselves or regional governments behave themselves just because there's a fiscal rule? Do you know that they're behaving themselves? So really, the importance of governance issues. Do you know who is spending what, where the liabilities are being generated, is a huge issue in Europe. It's been pushed under the carpet. It's a huge issue in China. So, you know, the fact that you have a buildup of liabilities in Europe, which were not detected, you know, what are the lessons from that for, say, India or China? So these are the questions that one's going to ask. So really, for us, who work across regions, as I said, I have a chair in China, I've been working on South Asia, I've been working on Indonesia, I've been working in Mexico, Brazil, Southern Cone. These are relevant issues. So you're talking about theory, you're talking about policy, policy implications. And we'll talk about each of these. So this is what the volume looks like. I'm going to circulate it. You can have a look. Please. It's my copy. Please return it. You know, publishers these days are very stingy. They don't give you very many copies. So there's a general introduction by the editors. Teresa Terminasian was a director in the IMF. She was my boss in the IMF. She writes about essentially about coordination of fiscal policies. What went wrong? What are the preconditions for fiscal rules? And I focus on governance issues. Governance issues are critical. Information management, institutions. What goes wrong in Europe with fiscal institutions? International experience and the European context. And essentially, you're looking across regions, across continents, in looking at institutions and whether they work or not. And, of course, there's a very fine chapter by Georg Milbrandt. Georg Milbrandt's a very important man. He is the president of the Forum of Foundations. He was the prime minister of Saxony. He is the vice chairman of the German Fiscal Council. And he's looking at this at the fissures in Germany. Now, the fissures in Germany I'm going to talk about a little bit. But this is a chapter that you should look at. And he's talking about, essentially, a cop-out which was done in Germany in 2007, which was to copy the Swiss debt brakes, stopping regional government, the lender, from borrowing. In 2019, it was done as a compromise. They had no idea what the implications were. 2019 is not that far away now, and this is a potential disaster waiting to happen. So if you're looking at the European Union, you're looking at problems. It's not Greece. It's the German debt brake, which you need to be focusing on. And then Bernd Spahn was the rector of the House of Finance at the University of Frankfurt. He has a very nice chapter on the German context. And we have a very nice chapter on France by Pierre Carello. Greece by Georgios Chortareas and Logothesis. Very nice chapter on Portugal by Professor Mario Fortuna of the Azores University. And then Spain, an absolutely fabulous chapter on Spain by Santiago Lago Peñas and Alberto Soleole, very famous writers on the Spanish context. And of course, then, of course, there's a paper on Italy by the editor, Massimo Bordigno, together with colleagues in Milan. So that's by way of countries in Southern Europe. And then there's a very interesting chapter looking at the role of investment, and particularly large investment in regenerating cities, because cities are so important in the context of sustainable development that we took a juxtaposition of Barcelona with Turin. Both cities have had very substantial investments due to the Olympics in both cases. In one case it's worked, in the other case it hasn't, and it's a paper by, not quite. I mean, he's from Turin, so he's naturally biased, but even he admits that Turin is not Barcelona. Not yet, but he's still hopeful. So are we, because we are frequent visitors. Absolutely. That's for a start. And then there's an issue of, you know, what is it for the accession countries? And if there are problems in Europe, should the accession countries want to remain accession countries? Or should you know, what is the incentives to join? Will these problems be fixed? Then, of course, there are a couple of general lessons about the political economy. My IMF colleague, Alex Murmuras, and Professor Rangasas of Indiana. And an excellent paper by Minervini and Vanella on looking at incentive issues and credible enforcement, in particular regarding investment issues. So questions about incentive structures and how you manage investments at the subnational level is a superb paper. So that's the volume. Let's start with why the Eurozone model is attractive, or so attractive to China, or attractive to Chile or Mexico, or if it is to India. Everyone's asking about the Eurozone model. Well, what's in it? Well, as I said, it was seen as an alternative to the top-down recommendation from the World Bank and the IMF that, you know, you do things the following way. Musgrave says you assign spending in the following manner and revenues in the following manner. It's all predetermined. Competition across the states will take care of accountability. So it's an alternative to the U.S. model. You have essentially what's come up as a positive theory of public finance built on the political economy approaches. So looking at incentive structures. So you've got the theory of yardstick competition, which whereby voters judge their governments in relation to performance in neighboring jurisdictions. It's bounded by a political process. Then you have got the principle of subsidiarity pushed down to the lowest level spending at which it can be efficiently managed. It makes very good sense. You know, it's intellectually appealing. That's what countries are trying to do. China, unfortunately, China has gone much further than subsidiarity, and I'll talk a little bit about that. The considerable flexibility on how countries actually arrange their institutions. So the idea is you let countries do what they like, and then you have a fiscal rule which says your deficit is going to be no more than 3%, or your debt stock is going to be X percent, 65, say. That's your Maastricht Agreement. You've got stocks and you've got flows. As long as you behave yourselves, you can manage your own affairs the way you want. So it's a very flexible system. So it looks very attractive in principle. So, you know, this was seen to perform better than the United States until around 2006-07. So the Eurozone was a zone of prosperity, employment generation, investment, growing faster than the U.S., and stable. So, and if you look at individual countries, the IMF and the World Bank have what's known as the ROSCs, as the standards of codes and other standards. So basically, it's a ticking exercise whereby you say, you know, budget ticked, accounting ticked, reporting tick. It's a box ticking exercise. And on that box ticking exercise, Greece actually scored very well. So, you know, the IMF said, you know, management of public finances, Greece, not a problem. But they didn't get into it. And once the crisis broke, what you found was that it was actually a very weak system, worse than you would find in many African countries, with accounts of municipalities written on pieces of paper, pushed up to Athens, and no idea what was going on. Really no idea. So the fact is that box-ticking exercise did not pick up the problems in Greece. So, but, you know, China is looking very carefully at the European Union. Latin America, no, it's a model. It seems to work. Then you have the crisis, and it doesn't work that well. And after the crisis in 2008, the U.S. has since recovered, but, you know, it's very weak recovery in Europe, if at all. So, and then, of course, the non-Eurozone countries, like the U.K., has actually done rather better than the Eurozone countries. So the question is, what's wrong in the Eurozone countries? Of course, what they did in 2008, most of the Eurozone countries, there was a counter-cyclical policies followed by the individual governments. Pump money to bolster demand. Now, of course, what that did was that it opened up pressures at the local level. It's also what China did around the same time. Pump money into the local governments to maintain demand. But then you build up pressure on the whole system and you see the faults. You see the faults in China, you see the faults in the European context. There were really two crises. 2008 response, by 2010, you could no longer do that. So you're back in 2010 in most of the European countries to tightening the belt. You're tightening the belt when you've already pushed out a lot of money and you don't know what's been happening to liabilities. So this is the issue. So Portugal and Greece found themselves into a true hole and liabilities they didn't know existed, even before this pump priming of 2008. By 2010, things were really quite desperate. In a lot of subnational governments along, particularly in Southern Europe, much the same situation in China. With pump priming exercise, push demand, you push cash out for demand expansion, and you have a problem. Spain, I was in the IMF board in 2008, and we had the Article 4 consultation by the IMF of the 2007 accounts. The IMF was patting both Ireland and Greece and Spain on the back for meeting Maastricht Treaty limits. But what the IMF didn't realize was that there were hidden liabilities. And suddenly the private liabilities that had been building up because people had been building these hotels and tourist facilities for Germans and Germans stopped coming, these private liabilities became public liabilities. Because they were financed by the state banks at the regional level, you had an explosion of the debt-GDP ratios from 35% to over 150% in Greece, likewise in Ireland. Both good... in Spain and Ireland. So private liabilities became public liabilities through the intermediation of the banking system, which means you have to be very careful about how you define liabilities. And the likelihood that private liabilities can become public liabilities is actually very strong. So what you find is that also that governments started playing games with each other, local governments with regional governments with national governments. And the games involved are essentially those of information, access to public services, social safety net, and a lot of pressure on these. So collapse of public services in Spain, pressure on Greece to rationalize huge number of municipalities, reduce employment at the municipal level. So there was that pressure. So how did they react? And then, of course, when you put pressure on the delivery of public services, the richer regions in Spain suddenly say, well, we're doing quite well. Why should we give money to southern Spain? So you have pressure to secede from Catalonia, saying, you know, we can do very well with our own resources. Why do we need to share our resources? It's the almost like what's known as the rich region syndrome, where you have, for example, Biafra with oil wanting to secede from Nigeria because they want to share it. Or in Indonesia, you've got the province of Aceh. It has the oil. It doesn't want to share it with anybody else. You've got the rich region syndrome. And that's what is coming to play in some of the southern European countries. Now, one of the issues that was very clear is that the institutions in a lot of these countries were not appropriate for the operation of yardstick competition. If you have too many levels of government, or some levels of government that actually don't perform any functions, but may have performed a function in medieval times. You know, China has five levels of government. You don't need five levels of government. Same thing in a number of European countries, Italy, for example. Same thing with cities, essentially a relic of the city-states of the medieval ages. They're still there, but they're not doing anything. So you've got levels of government, not clear what they're doing, either the number of governments or what they do, not clear. There's been an attempt to clean them up in France, in Spain, in Italy. Germany started cleaning up its public finances and assignments in 2004 because the German federal system, post-World War II, was designed by the Allies. And it was designed to stop Germany ever becoming strong again. Just to give you some examples. The German federal government does not have tax administration capabilities. It sets the tax policies, but doesn't collect any revenues. The German lender, the regions, don't have any policy functions. They just collect the administration. They just administer the taxes, but they can't make tax policy. Similarly, you have overlapping responsibilities on virtually everything is overlapping. So no one level of government is responsible for anything. And they don't have standardized information, so have no idea what's going on. So what they tried to do in 2004, and this was a coalition government between the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, it was a national coalition, was to try and fix it. It was called Federalismus Eins. And there were 15 elements, from the revenue assignments to who does what, spending, management, debt, et cetera, everything, transfer design, everything was to be cleaned up. And they were doing 15 items, one item at a time. It didn't work. They tried again in 2006. I was associated from the IMF with an attempt to fix this. We said, you will never fix it doing it item by item. And the suggestion was, look at what China did in 1993, 94. If you have a tax reform involving multi-levels of government, you can't only look at it as a tax reform. It's a tax reform, it's intergovernmental transfers, it's responsibility. So it has to be in more than one set of policy areas in order to offset gainers and losers. That's what the Germans didn't do, and it failed. Both Federalismus Eins and Federalismus Zwei failed, but then they pulled out a compromise, which was a debt break, which is a Swiss debt break, that the Swiss cantons are not allowed to borrow, but they can use their own source revenues to equilibrate. They put that in Germany, but the German lender don't have tax sources. So what's going to happen is a freight train going into a wall in 2019. This was a compromise in 2007, copied the Swiss debt break. But you don't have the same conditions in Germany as you do in Switzerland. So what they find themselves now is facing a wall which they're about to hit. And now they're back again to think about how to solve this entire Federalismus Eins und Zwei in a very short period of time. So it's, they don't have the right assignments in Germany. And it's very hard to do it. The other thing in Germany was, who generates liabilities? And do you know where they are? And, the International Public Accounts Standards Board, IPSAS, issued guidelines on recognizing liabilities from public-private partnerships, which essentially required that the government, if the government gets the asset at the end of the contract period, the liabilities should be shown on their balance sheets. And the European Commission agreed with that standard, together with the IMF's government financial statistics standards in terms of reporting budgets. They agreed with it, but it was opposed. It wasn't Greece that opposed it. It was Germany that opposed it for two reasons. One is that the German municipalities were full of debt. And had they recognized it, they would have gone over the Maastricht limits in 2004. They didn't do it. Then they built, they didn't do it. Still an issue. So that was a problem. So there's an idea of the mille feuilles, so sort of overlapping responsibilities in France, excellent chapter by Gorello, and then similar arrangements in Italy, multi-levels of government. It's also the case that the Chinese used multi-levels of government to manage, in the medieval times, an administration where you had limited information. So you use multiple levels to keep an eye on the lower levels. Similarly, in Mughal India, you had the same sort of arrangement, multiple tiers. You don't really know what's going on at the lower tier, but you want to keep them honest, so you need multiple tiers. So that's the situation from, medieval times. That's why these existed. You don't need them now. You don't need them now. And indeed, if you keep them now, then you don't have proper responsibilities. What own source revenues are you going to give five levels? Can't. So that's the problem. Italy's trying to clean it up. Germany tried, France, Spain tried to do it, but it didn't actually work very well. Italy's gradually moving towards that. So the incentives also of these multiple tiers to hire people, you make space for your friends and relatives. You hire your friends and relatives. That's what happens. And the last thing you want is to fire your friends and relatives, which is what would happen if you have a rationalization of these. That's why it doesn't happen. That's a political economy story, unfortunately. So, of course, there are incentives to hire. the incentives to have political influence, and there's no accountability. And of course, the Greek government was forced by the Troika to rationalize its municipal governments, fire people. But what did they do? They didn't just fire them. They, of course, removed them from the municipal roles. The central government then created public sector companies to rehire the same people to do what they were doing, but they were no longer in the books. They went off budget. So what changes? Nada. That's a problem. So all of a sudden, you have control, you have the Troika in there, rationalizing Greek governments. They're bringing some order in the actual public finances of the government sector, but then they're pushing stuff off budget. It's gone. You can't see it. Has it changed? Probably not. Of course, asymmetric arrangements in Spain with the Basque country having to keep all the revenues and higher levels of responsibility. Same in pressures coming now from Catalonia. We want to keep our money. If you don't like it, we'll secede. Now, of course, you know, if you're the richest region, you keep your money and you're better off. The same thing with the oil-producing regions. You know, you can always do better with 100%. That's the Biafra phenomenon. So the same idea that you have rich regions, they don't want to share their wealth with others. So that's the problem. So in order to counteract that, what you've had in Spain is recentralization, because the central government is still required to maintain some modicum of service delivery. So the system in Spain is under severe threat. And of course, there's the centrifugal forces. So I'll focus a little bit on governance failures, because I think this is the big lesson from Europe, is governance failure. So the first thing is that you have imperfect information within the Eurozone. So the Eurozone does not adopt the international standard on budgeting and budget reporting, which is the IMF standard. So having standardized information on what you spend on, where the money goes, where the revenues come from, that's an international standard. It's the IMF, the UN, and the OECD have developed the standard. China has adopted it. The European Union has not. They don't. So you don't have common standards, even though Eurostat attempts to expose, do some of that. So if you don't have full information, you have plenty of opportunity to play games between levels of government, between governments and private contractors. There's a leverage to recontract, especially in high-level profile cases. It's very common in India. You know, when you have elections, you can recontract. Public-private partnership is a bit of a disaster in India. So then hiding or non-recognition of liabilities, just keep them off the books. We'll talk a little bit about Madeira, which is extremely interesting, Portugal. And then, of course, off-budget vehicles to provide public services and employment for local services in the Greek case. You create companies, private companies, they're off the books. It's not our problem. We meet the letter of what we promised the IMF and the Troika. See, smaller government. But is it? Don't know. And as I said, extreme cases, the private liabilities became public debt, Ireland and Spain. So huge problem. All of a sudden, you don't have macro models that can pick up these types of risks. Madeira. Madeira has been run by a single president for 35 years, 40 years now. And he's been investing in hotels, five-star hotels, motorways, an airport on an island that doesn't have space for an airport, so it looks like an aircraft carrier out into the sea. Hugely expensive facilities for tourism. And, of course, building up, you know, the old tradition of Madeira as a staging point between Europe and Latin America and Africa. So that's what they think, the center of the world. Everyone comes to Madeira, apart from, you know, wanting to drink Madeira. So, basically, you know, generating Ponzi-type schemes. So, investments on borrowed money. Now, who's lending? Well, that's the problem. These are banks owned by the government. He owns the banks. And of course,
Lisbon has no idea.
You know, the debt of Portugal was 7 billion at the time of the crisis. 5 billion of that was in Madeira. And a large part of it was not known. Some of it was, and I'll show you. So they were disagreeing about pharmacies, healthcare, construction, and these types of things. They said, this is a central government responsibility. You pay for it. We're not going to pay. These are arrears to suppliers. Lisbon's responsibility. What you don't see are these construction costs. It's about €1 billion. This is €1 billion. So what he did was to tell the banks, don't send me invoices. He told the suppliers, don't send me invoices. Send them directly to the banks. The banks will settle with you. And I sit as chairman on the bank board of these banks. Don't worry. So this $1 billion was not known to Lisbon. So a quarter of the debt of Madeira was not known. €1 billion. And then, you know, its total debt was 127% of GDP, 900% of its annual revenues, half of it in state-owned enterprises. And that's what other countries are evolving towards, create state-owned enterprises to hide liability. So is that a model that will work? Well, the Portuguese Fiscal Council, which has very good people like Cardoso, who is the chairman, Jürgen von Hagen, who's a colleague at Bonn University, George Kopitz, a colleague from the IMF, and then a couple of very distinguished Portuguese academics, they are said you have to stop manipulation by the data of the data. You have to have standardized budget coverage. These are public spending. It should be recorded on the budget, even if it is an off-budget operation. This is something that China is beginning to do, by the way. Then you need to properly account for public-private partnerships and track them through a chart of accounts, as technical terminology. It was required in 2007. With 2 years' grace. And then they also said you have to have own source revenue so that the municipal governments bear responsibility for what they're doing. But the Portuguese parliament didn't accept it. Couldn't do it. Now, what the Ministry of Finance did was tighten up by the control board arrangement whereby they squeezed the cash, wouldn't give any cash. And that worked a little bit, but it's not sustainable. You remove the tourniquet, and it comes back again. And this guy is there to be for almost forever. He's going to be reelected. The central government is not. He is. So the problem hasn't gone away. It's been pushed aside, kicked down the road. Problem not solved. So what you need is to have institutions, economic classification, functions, programs, project outcomes, all of that. That's something that China is trying to do. So maybe Europe can learn from China in that respect. Then you need to manage your liabilities. The trouble is that in China, you can't put together balance sheets below the provincial level. It's too big. They're trying, but it'll take time. So actually, the extent of liability is not truly known. So, but you need to use these common international standards in order to do that. But they don't. If the European Union hasn't accepted these international standards, how are you going to start? So that's the problem. And before you start giving responsibilities to levels of government, you need to know what they're doing so that they can be held responsible by their electorate. If the electorate has no clue that what they're doing is their own responsibility or something mandated by Berlin or by Brussels, what are they going to judge them against? And especially when the local government does have own source revenues, just manna from heaven or from Berlin or from Madrid. You have no idea how to do yardstick competition. You don't know the extent of the liabilities to begin with either. So really it's somebody else's problem down the road. So really the system is broken. So what you need to do is begin to put together elements of clean governance, and you know, countries like Brazil are trying. You know, some of the problems are coming out because they have the ability to track the money. Where is it going? Who's stealing it? China, similarly. So some progress along these lines, which is useful for the European context. Now, the fact that you're following the international standard doesn't mean that the country or local government is subservient to the IMF. It doesn't. It just means you're using a standard for accountability. So, you know, when people say using standards in Europe will reduce the autonomy of local governments or central governments, that's not true. What it means is they'll become more accountable. Yes, certainly that. To their own electorate. But if the electorate doesn't know what's going on, they can't be accountable. So standards are very important, but it's completely ignored in the debate. It's not there. It's not what the debate's about. So that's the governance. Same thing with PPPs. The story of Professor Milbrodt, who was Prime Minister of Saxony, he said he would not allow any public-private partnerships in Saxony because he couldn't track them. This is Saxony in Germany. It's not the case that it doesn't happen in other German states. When he was Prime Minister, he didn't allow it because he said he couldn't track them. Now, you know, UK has been in the forefront of pushing public-private partnerships everywhere in the world. Of course, some of the biggest disasters with public-private partnerships, for example, London Underground. The House of Lords report, four volumes of what went wrong with the upgrade of London Underground 2004, the PPP contract that failed. So, you know, there are problems with PPP contracts. So unless you have common standards of how to manage these problems, which, of course, PPPs can be a very useful tool. Don't get me wrong, I'm not against PPPs. I'm just against PPPs being used as a means of kicking the can down the road, which is the way they were being used in Europe. So it's also a lesson for China. Because, again, going forward, the public-private partnerships are a key element in the restructuring and the investment strategy under One Belt, One Road. Now, it's true that they can play a role, but if they're not managed properly, there can be a problem. So how do you look at the risks at the subnational level? Well, there are issues that, of course, one can go into and managing asymmetric information and rent seeking. There's a lot of corruption in these contracts. You know, whether it's India or it's Brazil or Nigeria, you just have to watch these contracts. There's a lot of money in there. And of course, if you don't have on-source revenues, the local governments have no incentives to manage it properly, and they're the ones who are face-to-face with a lot of these contractors. So the incentive structures are not aligned in most countries, but also in the European Union. Of course, the urban hub story is critical for sustainable development. Everyone is talking about, you know, rebalancing within China or rebalancing across countries, and having new sustainable hubs is part of the sustainable development agenda. It's as critical in Europe as it is in India or China. Now, of course, if you look at the solutions, whether it's European structural funds or it's One Belt, One Road, is to build connectivity, a road or a high-speed rail link. Right? And that's what all these investments are about. But does it bring prosperity to depressed regions? Not necessarily. Italy has a very nice high-speed train from Turin to Milan to Rome to Naples. What has it done for Naples? Nothing. Just makes it easier for people to go from Naples to Milan, where the jobs are. The governance structures are not right in southern Italy. Same thing in Spain. So it's not enough to build a road. It's not enough to build a high-speed train. It might be necessary, but it's not enough. So you need the spokes, the hubs. Then you need the governance structures to make them work. That's where the example of the Olympics in Barcelona, as transforming Barcelona, put the Olympics in Barcelona, in the depressed region, a little bit like London. They put them in the depressed region. And then it's paid for by taxes in Barcelona, in the municipality. Wider municipality has a tax instrument, is willing to use it, and people are willing to pay to finance that investment. That's what you need to do in making these hubs sustainable. So the investment in Barcelona was sustainable. Investment in Torino was not that successful. because there wasn't the tax instrument. It was much too diverse. It was the Winter Olympics. So we did not have the effect of regeneration like the Olympics did in Barcelona. So the Olympics was fantastic for Barcelona. Not so good. It was marginally good, but not to the same extent as in Barcelona. And Milan is the hub. And the high-speed train takes people very quickly from Turin to Milan. It's very nice. Half an hour, you're in Milan. So the jobs move to Milan. So that's the worry. You know, you create these hubs from point A to point B. It may not do nothing in the middle. So, you know, that's the political economy story of the investments in these long-term investments. So you really have to think about what effect it's going to have, and also how do you make it sustainable at the local levels. So lessons, I'll be very quick. So there are issues within countries and across the Eurozone. Within each country, virtually every country, including Germany, there's unfinished business on the structure of government, who does what, how it's financed, what sort of instruments. And if you do macro stabilization in Greece or Portugal or Spain, without addressing these structural issues, it's going to really be kicking the can down the road. So you will not have the proper results. And this is also the lesson, big lesson for China. You know, you need all these elements in order to make the, for example, the new hub stick. So you want the artistic competition across counties, across countries, between countries and higher levels of government. So you need to be making sure that the decisions that are taken are responsible. And you need information for that. The information is an international standard, the IMF's GFS, or the IPSAS rules on managing public sector, public-private partnerships. Whether you're Germany or Greece or China, you're going to need that. China is at least trying to do it, which is more than one can say in either Greece or even Germany. Is the assignment right? You know, that was what Federalismus Eins und Zwei was about. Are the assignments right? They were not right then. And they haven't fixed it. In the Pakistan case, country that some of us know quite well, they tried to fix it, and there was unbundling of responsibilities from the Government of India Act 1935, but they didn't do anything on the revenue side. So with the unbundling of responsibilities, you essentially end up with unfunded mandates because you can't finance them. And then the whole thing collapses. So that's the problem when you don't do things which are properly sequenced. So the assignments in Germany failed. Rationalization of spending in Pakistan has failed, even though in legal terms the 18th Amendment went through. In effect, it has had no effect whatsoever. We had a very nice presentation the other day. So, of course, at the other end, the most decentralized country in the world is China. Most decentralized, including things like pensions and social security. Those were not local functions. So really, in the Chinese case, there needs to be some re-centralization of functions. And then decentralization of tax-raising powers. They don't have, local governments can't raise taxes. So any responsibility, any liabilities, essentially are Beijing's responsibility. Unfortunately, that's the case. And as you see, that's what's happening. So with asymmetric assignments, for example, in Spain or in Indonesia, these are not necessarily sustainable. Once you give more benefits to one region, everybody else wants the same. Or the region that has the higher benefits walks. So you either have centrifugal forces or the whole, you know, the central government just begins to collapse. Too many levels of government. Georgia will talk about that. People trying to address it. The UK and Portugal tried to create regional governments. UK under Prescott. They tried to create regional governments in the northeast of England, within England, and that didn't work. Didn't work. Portugal at the same time tried to create regions in mainland Portugal around the same time, around 2000, 2004. But it didn't work. Both of those were defeated in the referenda. And it's very interesting that that's the case because, you know, if you're getting something for nothing, why have responsibility? That's again a political economy conundrum. So rationalizing responsible levels of government is also hugely important in the Chinese context. Five levels is too much. There's been some experimentation with the NDRC starting in 2007 in some provinces. And you know, there's some idea that you can begin to build on that. But that's a long-term process. Now, the own source revenue issue is critical. And again, you know, none of the Chinese provinces have own source revenues. It is a huge problem in Germany with the German debt brake, because the lender are not going to be able to borrow. There are very negative implications for investment. Liabilities will be pushed down to the municipal level, as they are now, and you're not going to see them. So really, potentially, this is a huge, huge problem for the Germans. Then, of course, there are issues regarding the property tax we can go into. I think it's worth looking at. Standardized information flows. This is a theme. You need these standardized information flows. You don't have it, you can't do yardstick competition. Fiscal rules, can they work? But the preconditions are important. We've talked about all the preconditions. Information, own source revenues for accountability. And you don't have them in most of these cases. So, you know, how do you carry out a fiscal compact without hurting growth and long-term employment? Well, that's a huge problem in Europe. That hasn't been addressed. And then the political economy constraint. How much adjustment before there's a loss of political support, loss of benefits, sharp rise in employment, particularly the youth? Look at Spain. And then the cuts in investment coming through the rules to coming down the road. That's, again, going to have a knock-on effect on jobs and job creation. And then, of course, made worse by refugees and immigrants. Then challenge to regenerate, then think about public hubs, where is the money going? There's a lot of thinking in the UK about regenerating northeast of England. What do you do differently to regenerate northeast of England? It's not just spatial dynamics. There's a lot of work on spatial dynamics. It's also governance, making sure that the incentive structures are right. So this brings us back to the political economy of the whole story. It has to be a package. So really what we end up by saying is that the European project is a viable project in an increasingly competitive world. This is very, very very, very competitive era, whether you're in China or you're in Latin America. So these large groupings are really actually quite important, whether you're in the European context or you're GCC or you're ASEAN or you're the Latin cone. So really building regional synergies to stay afloat is extremely important. And then macroeconomic stabilization without genuine multi-level structural reforms will only kick the can down the road, so be careful. And all the things we've talked about will take time, but are necessary. So really what we have is a big story on the lessons from Europe, but that's really the active agenda for China or India or indeed Brazil. So I'll stop with that and ask Giorgio Brosio, who will talk about some of the specific countries going forward and essentially what actually has happened in some of them since we wrote the book. Georgia.
Good afternoon to everybody, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and co-editor, for giving me the floor. I intend to be brief and just to give you some information about some insight about three case studies. The intent of my presentation is to give you some insight about the content of single chapters. Second point that I will make, and continuing what Etisham mentioned many times, many of the problems that the Eurozone has met in this area derive from the fact that according to the EU, local government is exclusively a national domestic competence. So the EU institutions, they are not interested, at least they have not yet intervened in this field. Despite the fact, and this is a problem that the EU institution, the different institutions maintain, they have created a very dense network of relationship, of financial and economic relationship with subnational government. For example, the idea of the Europe of regions was started by the EU institution, and now in view of this secessionist tendency prevailing in some countries, I mean, the EU has retreated, but the EU has intervened and is still intervening. Created dense relationship, dense network of relationship, but without, considering the implication of this network of relationship for introducing and or for considering problems of financial stability, of macroeconomic governance. So and there is some contradiction. I mean, from this point of view, I mean, there is from the only similarity possibly of the EU institution from this point of view with the American, with the US institution is that the EU, the federal, so-called federal institutions do not intervene in the realm of local and regional government. But also they don't, I mean, they don't intervene from the institutional point of view, they intervene on the financial and economic point of view with this intervention, but they don't use, they don't exploit the implication. So while if you consider the case of the US, federal government is this sphere which is completely separated from state and local government, but the federal government intervenes with a huge number of transfer, and usually it attach strings and constraints, which sometimes help. I mean, the overall governance of the system. While the EU attach strings to its program, but strings, for example, additionality, are mostly referred or intended to enhance and to show the role of the community instead of, providing instruments for, good governance of the financial institution. Okay. The third aim is simply to show the variety of situation prevailing within, inside member countries in terms of the in terms of decentralized and regional government, and possibly, if we consider this huge variety, then we start understanding also why possibly the EU institutions do not want to intervene into this realm, because the variety, going back to tradition, is so huge that every attempt to start unifying and put some uniformity will meet obstacles and opposition. And in fact, I'm considering here, I'm presenting a few slides on three cases, Spain, France, Spain, and Italy. And they're also interesting from the point of view that all of them, the three of them, they share the same Napoleonian tradition of decentralized government, but despite this common tradition, they show huge variety, and especially, we can also see a big difference in reaction, impact and reaction to the crisis. So we start briefly with France. As we know, France is a very complex network of subnational government. Just to mention that France has 36,000 municipalities. Every small hamlet in the countryside has a municipality, meaning that there's a huge number of municipal employees and huge number of municipal councillors, elected officials. Okay. And the system is changing. In fact, the French expert, not only, but also the French authority, they call now the millefeuille, that's a cake with many layers of cream and pastry. And it's changing all over the time. Of course, it has not only a huge number of units at each layer, but also four or five layers of government according to the definition. And so because of this complexity, this overlapping of functions, of tax bases, there are some peculiarities. For example, in the French system, there is a property tax which is shared between three levels of government. As in other countries, I mean, Germany, Spain, and Italy, the local government in France were relying on a local business tax, that tax professionnel, which was eliminated in 2010 and substituted with a complex system of transfer, which reduced the transparency in intergovernment fiscal flow. Anyway, if you come to the crisis of 2008, I mean, given the control that the central government still has on its local government through a combination of law, fiscal rules, and administration rulings, more or less the central government was able to manage the crisis, at least in the sense that French local governments fared relatively well, and as shown by the relatively small fall of local public investment. However, of course, the central government had to bear the cost of the intervention, and this also contributed to the breach of the European Eurozone limits on general government debt. And also, as you know, France, also with Germany, was allowed to keep a share of deficit higher than that prescribed by the rules, which created, for example, a lot of dissent in Italy. Anyway, after the crisis, the central government has tried hard to contain the cost of local government through structural reform. Trying to reduce the number and fragmentation of governments, and also to reduce the numbers of layers. The results are mixed. And political terms are also easy and sometimes not easy to understand. For example, France has been very successful in reducing the number of regions, something that would be considered impossible to do in Italy or in Spain, of course. But from one day to the other, the French government decided to halve the number of regions, and the law was passed last April, and last December they had already election for the new region. So this is astonishing, successful in terms of time taken, attempt of reform. While number of fragmentation of municipality, there is a lot of talk, always been a lot of talk, project, discussion in France about reducing the number of municipality, but the number of municipality remains more or less the same. There are many reasons, but also as we explained, Etisham and myself in another paper, also which this presentation is built. One of the main political economy reasons is that reform of the local government is to be initiated in the Senate, in the upper chamber. And the upper chamber is elected mainly by 90% by delegates from the municipal council. So it's quite unlikely that French senators are ready to accept a reform that will reduce or kill the role. Another reform which has been tried is to create metropolitan government or to extend metropolitan government to the big urban areas. But these governments are still weak because mostly for two reasons. One, they are devoid of own revenues. And second, the council are still chosen indirect, so they are appointed by municipal council, which makes them weak political. And the third element is the departments, the prefecture, which were the dominating layer of government in the past from the political administrative point of view. And there have been many reforms that have been announced about their elimination, but they have also been maintained. So the idea now is to reconsider this issue in 2020. So, I mean, French government had been partially successful, very partially in controlling and, I mean, reforming the structure. But what is a bigger problem, or still a problem, is that the central government is still unable to control the long-term evolution of the local finances. For example, the number of employees of municipalities, which is already bloated, 1.3 million of people, a huge number, maybe the highest number in Europe, continues to grow, and within the expenditure for salaries and then for recurrent expenditure, meaning that investment expenditure is sacrificed and the stock of debt continues to rise. So, I mean, the financial performance of local government in France is mixed, the recent one. Prospect, I mean, one doesn't have to be totally negative. I mean, the new larger regions are expected to increase efficiency of investment and to improve growth prospect, because the region is mainly responsible for coordination of growth promoting policies. I mean, critical prospect, the problem is that France need strategic, comprehensive, long-term approach to reform, to control the growth of the public sector that, as I said, is already inflated. So, I mean, this reform should include consolidation of municipality, assignment of all revenues to the metropolitan government, and deciding the fate and the role, once for all, of the departments. And then I come to Spain, which is different. The mold is the same, but the impact and the reaction to the crisis have been different. Main aspect that comes out from the volume we edited is that, the crisis, was exacerbated by the previous boom of subnational revenue, which was induced by, As we know, Spain had a boom of construction and real property. Subnational government, municipality, and regions have revenue sources which are strictly linked to the property, to the construction sector, and to the property market. They have a tax on sales of land and of real property. Of course, when price of property go up very rapidly, and the number of transactions increases also very rapidly during a boom, revenue increase. And, only the property tax played a kind of stabilizing role because, the property, the assessed base were not revaluated. So, anyway, local government, local regional government enjoyed a boom of revenues. This translated into boom expenditure. When the crisis came, crisis came with the explosion of the bull, the property bull. Then, all level government, particularly local and regional government, experienced a severe financial crisis with rapidly increasing deficit, debt levels, and also serious, big problematic cuts in the level of service provision. And of course, government debt, general government debt increased, and also also deficit exceeding the Maastricht limits. Then, when the crisis was over, the central government tried to regain control, again trying structural reform. What did the they did. Mainly the central, in this recent year, until last election, Spain has been governed by the center-right party, the Popular Party. Tried to shift responsibility from municipality to the autonomous communities. There was also an important decision, which is it's considered with skepticism among experts. The central government decided to make the provinces which are the intermediate level of government, and which was considered to be the candidate, serious candidate for elimination, because it was the traditional old layer of government, which also, also very, very bad reputation, political reputation linked to the Francoist regime. And so there was discussion, as in France, about the elimination of provinces, but at the end the government made the provinces responsible for the provision of urban of the urban services in small municipalities. I mean, Spanish municipalities under 20,000 inhabitants have to transfer responsibility for the provision of the urban service to the province, which means that the role of the provinces, instead of having been reduced, or instead the province of having been eliminated, their role has been enhanced, okay, which could be a problem. Anyway, also at the same time, we have to recognize that Spanish government introduced some new legal instruments, such as a law on budgetary stability, a law for rationalization and sustainability of local administration in 2013. And so, for example, from the point of view of putting control, certain control or a break on municipal debt, I mean, Spain has been successful for municipalities, while at the same time the debt of the autonomous community, that is of the region, continues to grow, reaching a huge, important share of GDP, higher than 26%, and also with increasing difficulty by the region to pay arrears. So, Spain, as Hisham pointed out many times, presentation is this asymmetric arrangement. It's not simply symmetric. It's facing, rather strong secessionist or autonomist pressure from two important regions. So it's, governance of the regional level of the autonomous communities is almost impossible now. Mm-hmm. Prospect. Spain is doing better. Than Italy or France. Growth has resumed, quite satisfactory. And also the reform implemented, as I said, are easing pressure on the public finance. Critical. Many critical points for Spain, especially referring pertaining to the political realm and to the side. There are still, centrifugal tendencies which are getting stronger the national structural party, the socialist, the popular party, are losing strength electorally. So, and they are replaced by smaller party, new parties, and also by regional. And of course, Spain was considered a beautiful experience when the return to democracy, a perfect experience of democratic government with perfect alternance in power, 5 years each to the popular party and to the socialist. But now, parties are unable to reach an agreement. And they will have a new election in December, I guess. So political uncertainty, of course, reduces the feasibility of further adjustment and reforms. And also, unfortunately, Spain has been, confronted with, huge surge of corruption cases. Confrontation between the judiciary and the executive, but this impacts negatively on the credibility of politicians and on their capacity of finding and proposing a compromise between gainers and losers from possible reform. Italy, come to last case, I mean, which is different because Italy had no real property boom. 2007-8, when the crisis erupted, the public finances were already in a dire situation. And so the government was not able to operate a counter-cyclical policy when the crisis hit in 2008. So Italy had a massive, still experienced huge, massive losses of output and employment. And I mean, partially recovered by 2010, but then there, 2011, there was the, euro crisis, which a massive capital flight, and the spread between the Italian bonds, and the interest on the Italian bond and the German bonds, which are the benchmark, went to the stars. And I mean, there were doubts about the sustainability of the debt, and in fact, the government, Mr. Berlusconi, was forced to step down and was replaced by a so-called technical government, Mr. Monti, which forced the country to embark on a severe fiscal adjustment that plunged the economy into a more severe recession. Implying, among other things, that the level of public service had been curtailed in many, many basic areas. At the same time, I mean, again, we don't want to be totally negative, but also to see, look at positive facts. I mean, the impact of the crisis and of the subsequent intervention of the central government do not have only negative implications. For example, the central government has been forced to increase tax autonomy at the local level, which we, experts of public finance, we appreciate. I mean, we consider it's important for accountability. Also, the central government was able to improve accounting procedures and also to contain political cost of local government by, intervening on salaries, remuneration. Also, the parliament has approved recently, last month, a constitutional reform which reduced, among other things, the number reduces the not the number, the function and the resources of the regions, eliminates the province at the intermediate level of government, which is, so in some extent the structure of subnational government has been streamlined. Mm-hmm. So the Italian government has been able to eliminate provinces which are the perfect equivalent of Spanish province and the French department, but mostly because, according to our interpretation, provinces are no more important from the electoral point of view. Electoral constituency for the national parliament are totally in Italy are now totally separated from the province, while in France the department are still, the main reference point for the electoral colleges of the lower house and municipalities, as I mentioned, are fundamental, critical for the appointment of senators. But coming back to Italy, if you want to be positive, there are signs of easing of the crisis. Yeah? They are slowly appearing, although Italian growth remains anemic now. But at the same time, the constitutional reform, for example, we also have a reform of the Senate, of the upper chamber, which reduces the degree or intensity of bicameralism in Italy, should expand the role of the capacity of the central executive to govern intergovernmental relations. There are also many critical prospects. One of them, or maybe the main, is that the EU rules may further require to Italy, to introduce painful adjustment. And painful adjustment to be introduced with the public opinion, which is increasingly hostile, I mean, let's say, to European rules, if not to European institutions, want to stay with them. Another problem is that austerity measure and also reliance of on revenues have increased regional gaps. And so, I mean, also this, I mean, the South is lagging back more than they used to lag with reference to the other regions of the country. So, meaning that, I mean, equalization grants, I mean, Italy has to make an effort to improve equalization, to increase equity, and also reduce opposition reform and to further grow prospect, but in a framework of possible new fiscal adjustment, I mean, even equalization, I mean, perspective of equalization grants becomes a difficult perspective. Okay, very short conclusion, because here I am repeating what I said from the beginning and also repeating what it is said before. I mean, the current stance at the European level is local government is an exclusive national competence, and this is no longer tenable. And the crisis and the volume show, I mean, that this is no longer tenable. Mm-hmm. The implication, what we said, the implication for financial stability and macroeconomic control of the existing extensive network of relationship between the EU and the institution of some national government to be considered. And as to repeat, as also already it is mentioned, that, I mean, standards, for example, for reporting, provision of for liabilities, especially in the case of private-public partnership, coverage of state-owned enterprise are essential to introduce in light of the economic crisis. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I mean, nationally, we didn't, I mean, the book makes extensive reference, I mean, analysis of the national and subnational stability pacts, but of course, I mean, they cannot function between, I mean, introduction and use of information standards. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for staying. We have a little time, and I don't think they'll kick us out if we go over. We have time for questions, so maybe there are a few questions and then we can answer. Please let me know if you want to ask a question or make a comment.
Okay. Thank you very much for this excellent presentation. My question probably is a side issue, but don't you think that the fact that the Eurozone was not constructed as a sort of optimal currency area, Robert Mandel's famous theory, so the fact that the country that constituted the Eurozone, they were not converging country, they were very heterogeneous, the northern and the southern countries were very different. And as a result, the southern countries that they were, the focus of discussion today is Spain, Portugal, they borrowed heavily at a very cheap rate as a result of being in the Eurozone. So my question is that, don't you think it's the formation of Eurozone which is under question, rather than simply the institution and fiscal policy?
Good. Let's take another question.
I wanted to ask you what factors make it difficult for Germany to meet the Swiss bank rating, because you mentioned that they're going to hit the wall. So which are those factors which makes it so difficult for Germany?
Any other questions? Thank you. So you mentioned the difference between Europe and China. Are you saying that China is in a better position to survive in the long term, especially to face all the easing and all the, you know, extra money that we have in the markets? So is it in a better position than Europe, or what's the situation? Three very good questions. Let me start by Georgia. Would you like to say something?
Okay.
I'll start by the Chinese question. I think the Chinese model is quite different from the yardstick political accountability models in the West. The Chinese model is one of administration. Governors are appointed and promoted according to various criteria. And that's a model which was used over centuries. You can call it the Confucian model. So in a sense, that model is less prone to the gyrations that you see in the Western world. But if you don't have full information, it can break down very easily. And indeed, over history, you've seen examples of when the governors have become corrupt, the empire has had its downturns. And the worst periods, for example, in the 1930s, was breakdown of the Confucian model. And indeed, the model begins to break down when you have corruption. So I think what you see now in China is the realization on the part of the leadership where this model will not work if there is corruption. So you have the effort to build up the information systems and then also punish people who are seen to be corrupt. So I think basically they're doing the right things, but a lot of the institutional and informational mechanisms are not yet in place in China because it's a huge country and setting up these budgets and accountability systems takes time. Though they know what needs to be done, and it's happening. So the long-term prospects for China, of course, I think are in general good. Probably better than Europe, I would say. You know, it's a toss-up. The German question is actually very interesting. And what people worry about is that the debt rate essentially means no investment, no borrowing at all. So if you can't borrow, you can't invest. So what happens to sort of huge investment programs in Germany? You have sort of a flexibility with your own source revenues, you wouldn't be so rigid. But as it happens, most of the variance that will come in government operation will be pushed down to the municipal level, where already you don't know what to get. So it's a big unknown. So it could lead to a lot of fissures in the social compact in Germany. So that's what people are worried about. And as I said, there are two chapters on Germany. One is a general chapter on how debt rates work and the history of the German federal system by Georg Benzmann, beautifully written. And the other one, more forward-looking, by Bernd Spahn, again, really answering your question. Again, you've got an excellent question. I'll come back to it. I'll ask Georgia to have the first go. I have my views on this too. Question from the lady about the north and the south.
But I agree with you.
Georgia.
Also, I guess it's one of the first statements of the introduction, joint introduction book, that what is missing in the federal European institution fiscal policy, federal European institution, but especially for the euro area. So one of the main not conclusion but arguments we make in the introduction of this book is that most of the problems that countries in the eurozone have experienced during this crisis are due to this missing part, missing a fiscal institution. So forced, member countries, which in a federal optics are the federated state, subnational level, to intervene and to solve, operate counter-cyclical policy, but at the same time within the constraint imposed by the EU institutions. I mean, there is there are a blatant contradiction in it's visible, no? And also we suggest that the next step or main step, Euro area, so in general, European institutions have to take, solving, giving to the center, to the European institutions, some leeway, some lever, fiscal, to help, after some counter-cyclical policies to the new crisis.
Coming back, my take on that also is that you can ask that question, and you can ask why Southern Europe went into it and why Northern Europe agreed to this union. Of course, there were gainers on both sides. Southern Europe was able to borrow cheaply, and Northern Europe was able to export its goods in a way that it could not otherwise have been. But then the idea, the hope was that you get better integration that way. Now, integration doesn't come about that way, unfortunately. And indeed, this is a big issue in the Chinese context, because when you create hubs, for example, the hubs that were created in China along the coast, and they were along the coast for a very good reason, is that that's where you had the populations initially, and then that's where you had the migrations. So 170 million people moved from the interior of China to the coasts to create these mega hubs. So when I was in Guangzhou in 1987, there was a small fishing village of 100,000 people called Shenzhen. It's now 25 million. And the Pearl River Delta is 50 million, the biggest conglomeration in the world. You can't put more people in there, so really you have to think about where the hubs are going to be put and what is public policy to create new hubs and rebalance. Now, China can do that, coming to your question, China can do that through public investment. This whole idea of the cross-border connectivity to reduce costs by exporting to Central Asia or Iran or Pakistan or Burma, which is part of the One Belt, One Road Initiative, is to reduce costs in the interior. So you can't actually move production into the interior until you change the cost structure. But in order to do that, you need investment and you need, as Professor Brozio was saying, you need transfers. And you need fiscal policy instruments to make that happen, which is easier to do in a unified state like China than it is in a loose, not even a confederal structure. But you know, the European Union doesn't have sources of income. It's got small items like the customs duty, but practically nothing compared to what's actually needed. So the instruments, the fiscal instruments, are not there in the European Union to do the rebalancing, which could happen, that would provide employment opportunities. The other point is, you actually don't have free movement of labor. I mean, in principle, yes. But, you know, when you have too many poles moving to the United Kingdom, you have Brexit. So, you know, if you have the Greeks and the Italians moving to Germany, in addition to the Syrians and the Iraqis, you have political problems. So it's not clear that the actual free movement of labor, goods and services, which is in the European, you know, it's part of the European compact, you must have free movement of labor, but in a matter of fact, in reality, it's not. It is a sticky labor market. And you get too many claimants for benefits, and then you get other reactions. So in a sense, some of the promise of the creation of the unified economic space, as indeed you do have in the United States, you know, you have a unified space of people, goods and investment move very freely, that you don't have in the it's there, but in legal terms, but in actuality, it's much harder. Which is different from either the United States or China. Any other questions or comments?
Japan and Brazil. So, don't worry, I don't need the mic.
Yeah. No,
so Japan and Brazil.
Yeah,
so I'm also
Yeah. I wanted to ask, you know, there is a lot of currencies around China have devalued against the Chinese currency. Why is there so much of worry as far as the EU goes and you know, some of the more developed nations go for the Chinese currency to get devalued further and find a...
Well, what they have done, what the Chinese have done, let me come to take the currency issue first. The yuan, the Chinese yuan was undervalued for many, many years. As a matter of fact, that was one of the key instruments that was used in order to stimulate growth and exports. But then, over time, the yuan was allowed to reach its market value. So, and again, before they got into the IMF SDR basket, you know, they were pretty much at market level. So they got to the SDR level, and they did it very carefully. At the time, the pressures were for downward movement of the yuan. So it's actually now moving, according to market market forces, a member of the IMF's basket. So for the last few years, there was an appreciation. It's now beginning to adjust, it's adjusted downwards. Not because it's being manipulated. You know, there was a long debate in the US Congress about the US and the Chinese currency being manipulated. You know, that's not the future rest. So the Chinese currency is actually moving according to market. So it's moved down.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, sort of capital movements and quite a lot of capital movements around China, so there's a downward pressure. So, you know, other currencies worry, other countries worry. You know, if you were Pakistan, for instance, you would. You would, because you are competing with Chinese goods. And the Chinese now have an efficient fiscal system with the proper refunding value added tax, which takes out all the tax element in the price of goods when they export. And now that you have the connectivity, not only are you taking the tax out of the exports, but the transportation costs have been reduced or half or you know, sort of made nominal. So you're going to have these guys are going to have a problem in competing. And especially if you accept $50 billion in terms of investment in the infrastructure, you can't then put countervailing tariffs on Chinese goods. So you know, Pakistan industry has a shock waiting for it. So that's why countries are worried. Maybe Pakistan hasn't yet realized that it has a problem, but it does. Now, you know, the only way to learn from China and to use Chinese assistance properly is to learn from China and actually do the reforms that Chinese have done in the last 20 years. I'm not sure I remember your question. Yeah, I mean, this is not a book about macro policy and quantitative easing. Now, of course, in Japan, you have the need for quantitative easing. In Europe, you have the need for quantitative easing because the countercyclical fiscal policies are not enough. And you know, there's a case being brought. This is just the Financial Times case being brought by a number of German interest groups against the ECB and the Bundesbank for the quantitative easing, saying that this is creating all the right-wing tendencies that you see in Germany. You know, it has a political connotation, but the European Court of Justice dismissed that case. So, you know, it's up to governments to use whatever instruments you've got. There's a limit to how far you can. And the U.S., which used it actually very efficiently and effectively, is now in the cycle of moving out of it. And that's going to be a big problem for everybody else, which hasn't yet come out of the recession. So a lot of the European countries, and especially emerging market countries, where you see rising world interest rates for the U.S. to stop the corporate So it's very interesting, as we say, very, very interesting time. Can't actually predict what will happen to Japan or Brazil. Brazil, of course, has huge fiscal problems. Japan will likely continue with quantitative easing and get away with it because it can. Brazil has huge political problems with a dreadful fiscal infrastructure, but that's another story. Brazil, of course, is one where I think very many, some of these implications go straight through to Brazil. As I mentioned, I was at a conference organized by the state finance ministers in Brasilia last September, and this was the issue. How do you carry out structural change which involves governance reforms in a country like Brazil, where government after government after government have tried over the last 20 years and have failed? So you wait for a crisis, and then you hope that the fact that you have a crisis focuses people's attention to the key issues and then get done. So I think the crisis is there now. Let's see if they take advantage of it. The trouble is that you've got so many gainers and losers in this situation, going in different directions. Now, look at the German structural reforms. Everyone knows that these assignments imposed on them after the Second World War are inefficient. Everybody knows. Right wing, left wing, center, everyone knows. But once it comes to making these changes, you can't do it because you have gainers and losers. They couldn't do it. Not one of the 12 items on federalism's Einstein was addressed. Not one. And the step rate was plucked out of the air as a compromise to show that this commission over 2 years of a national unity government did something. As a matter of fact, it did nothing. So, and indeed, what they have actually shown as the as their success is actually a dreadful, shall we say, albatross that they're going to have to deal with very quickly, because 2019 is on the corner. And it's okay to say in 2007, if a debt break will come into effect in 2019 and declare that as a victory. It's quite another thing to be facing that when trade is about to hit the wall. So that's what they're facing now. But the people are aware of it. They're working to see. I don't know if they do. But the same issue in Brazil. Much harder in a big federal state like Brazil, where a lot of corruption, a lot of rent-seeking, gainers and losers, haven't been able to address it. Maybe this crisis would focus the minds. But again, you must take India, for example. So fixing the value-added tax, proposed by Congress, shut down by BJP. Now the BJP and government are putting forward the same proposal because they know that they need to be able to compete against the Chinese, but have reduced the cost of doing business. Shut down by Congress. Can't get it. Everybody agrees it needs to be done. BJP and Congress both know that it has to be done. It has to be done to be able to compete in an increasingly competitive world. They can't do it because it's politically competitive. So that's where, again, some of the lessons from here are actually quite useful. How do you get it done? So anyway, thank you again for coming. And not exam time, but thank you very much.